Hello, it's Thursday, February the 16th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Joining me in studio today, Dr. Annalise Anderson, Hoover Institution Senior Fellow, Presidential Aide and Advisor, and author of many a great book, too many, in fact, to list in the limited time we have today, though I'd point you to two in particular that she co-edited with her husband, the late Martin Anderson, and that would be Reagan in His Own Hand and Reagan, A Life in Letters. They're tremendous reads. Please go get them if you haven't read them already. Dr. Anderson has also helped two winning presidential campaigns make the switch to governing, and that's our topic today, presidential transitions. Now, what a transition is? It's essentially building a workforce of about 8,300 employees, which is the equivalent of Gilead Sciences or the McCormick Spice Company. And those 8,300 workers are tasked with running a little $3.8 trillion operation that we call the federal government. Now, writing in the book Revolution, the Reagan Legacy, Martin Anderson describes presidential transitions as a time of, in his words, delicious chaos. You and I have talked about this beforehand, and you describe transitions as, in theory, fun.
Yes.
So you've watched the Trump transition. What's going on here, chaos or fun?
Well, I think it is chaos, but the basic idea is that after all, these people have won the election. They're part of the team that succeeded in getting this president elected, mm-hmm. and they should be happy and enthusiastic, and generally I think they are, and they should be thrilled. Here you elect the leader of the free world, right?
Right.
That's one of the highs. It's like winning the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Now, a transition doesn't begin the day after the election. A transition actually begins long beforehand. I believe under federal law, you have to have a transitional organization in place by June, I believe.
I think June 1st mm-hmm. is the new arrangement.
So Donald Trump's approach to the transition was what? How does he differ from other presidents? And let's talk in particular about who he puts in charge of the transition originally.
Well, I think originally Chris Christie was in charge of the transition. Mm-hmm. And a couple days after he was elected, he changed that. He fired Christie and put somebody else in charge, I think his vice president, Mike Pence.
He did. And why did he fire Christie, who was the governor of New Jersey, for those who don't know who Chris Christie is?
I believe it was because he felt that the people that Chris Christie was working with or putting in charge of different areas of this transition were heavily lobbyists, is one argument. Anyway, he didn't like the people. So this is a conflict among people.
Right. And you mentioned that he put in place Vice President Mike Pence. Now, you have worked on two presidential transitions. You worked on Richard Nixon's 1968 to 1969 and Ronald Reagan's 1980 to 81. Reagan did not have sitting governors in charge of his transition, nor did Nixon. They had who? Longtime aides, right? People they were familiar with.
Well, the Richard Nixon transition, somebody suggested that something had to be done. And there was somebody selected who was Glenn Olds. Basically, he was selected to look at possible people who could serve in the administration. Mm-hmm. And Glenn Olds turned out to be a Democrat and a fairly left-wing Democrat. And the people that he recommended, we had no computers at this time, so these were paper files. The people he recommended were so inconsistent with Nixon's basic approach to government, mm-hmm. that these files were simply discarded. We had transition offices in the Pierre Hotel, among other places, and we took these files and put them in the bathtub and started over. And so basically, that was really the extent of the Nixon transition. It's essentially a personnel problem. Who's going to run this government for you? And there are 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 important positions. It varies from administration to administration, and you try to fill as many as you can and try to take the people who have worked for your campaign, possibly across the country in different kinds of jobs, if they want to work for your administration, to find an appropriate job for them and to recruit other people and place them in positions where these are all policy positions where they can carry out your ideas and turn your ideas and basic political philosophy and basic proposals into concrete policy and legislation.
Now, in 1980, Ed Meese runs the transition.
Ed Meese ran the transition. He was in charge of the transition after the election took place. Before that, he asked Penn James, who was a headhunter, a recruiter, running a large firm, helping businesses find people. And he asked him to set up the basic system for inputting resumes and providing the information so that people could look up a particular job or a particular person or say, who's recommended this person? And so the resumes were input. And so that system existed and was available once the transition staff was set up. And Ed Meese surely did run it, but not before the election.
Ed Meese went back to California with Ronald Reagan, back to his Sacramento years. So I would assume that Ed Meese So Ed Meese would understand what Ronald Reagan wanted in the way of
Absolutely. So Ed Meese was heading that up, and the people that were going to be recommended to the president went through a committee that included Ed Meese and Martin Anderson and other people, and then on to the president for his appointment.
And this was also in the age of computers now, so you had digital support on that as well.
Right, which is very important.
So you and I talked about transition before this podcast, and I took down some notes that you shared with me. And one thing that you brought up is the importance of a publication called The Plum Book.
Right.
Explain The Plum Book to me.
The Plum Book, the formal name of The Plum Book, is the United States Government Policy and Supporting Positions. And that's the critical part of it. It's published every 4 years, right after the election. It was published December 1st, 2016. So just 3 weeks after the election, and it lists all the positions that are presidential appointments, some with Senate confirmation, some not, and all the other positions in government that are not civil service or are executive civil service where a choice can be made by the head of an agency or a department. And so there are over 8,000 positions in there. There are 1,200 and some that are presidential appointments with Senate confirmation. This includes some things that aren't really important. Right. It may include some commissions that are volunteer commissions. And those aren't really critical. But a lot of these are the critical positions, the deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, top aides who run the government.
Right. You actually were kind enough to break down the numbers for me. So 8,358 jobs available in the Plum Book.
Right.
1,242 are presidential appointments with Senate confirmation. 472 are presidential appointments, and 6,644 are policy and supporting positions made by agency heads and others. So that takes you to 8,358. Why is it called the Doomsday Book?
Oh, the party in power at the time of the election, the losers, call it the Doomsday Book because they're going to lose these jobs. And it's the Plum Book because of people coming in. This is what they look through to say, let's see what I want. Would I like to be Associate Director of the Office of Management and Budget, you know, or would I like to be deputy, would I like to be in charge of tax policy at the Treasury? Hey, that's good, right?
Right.
And certainly Trump is going to do something in that area, and it's critical to get something done.
Right. Now, three words stood out in the notes that you sent to me, and those three words are people or policy.
Right.
Explain what you mean by that, people or policy.
Well, I think the essential job of a transition is to take the people who have been working in your campaign organization and with their help, and specifically these people, and move them into government jobs, whether it's in the White House or in the departments, where they can run your government. And these people are the people who know what you want to do and understand what you think and are able to apply their knowledge to the specifics of the job that they take, like writing a tax bill, right, or negotiating a tax bill, or promoting a tax bill with the Congress to argue in support of the president's policies. Mm-hmm. And so these people, the people become the vehicle by which your policy becomes reality.
Right. Now, something else you emphasized is the concept of tiers to appointments, if you will. That's T-I-E-R-S, not tears as in flowing out of the eyes. And that's, we obsess over who's going to be a cabinet pick, who's going to be an ambassadorial pick, and so forth. But what you would emphasize is that sub-cabinet positions matter mightily to a new administration. And these are complicated positions to fill.
Yes, they are complicated positions to fill. If you're recruiting from outside,
right,
you want people who are really doing a pretty good job. They may be in their 40s, mm-hmm, or 50s. Some of them may be younger or older, but people in their 40s or 50s have jobs that they're,
right,
becoming recognized in their fields for doing. They've got a wife or a husband who's also working. They may have kids, especially kids in high school. When, mm-hmm, I was recruiting for the Reagan administration, I had somebody that I thought was really good that I was talking to on the phone, and he said, Annalise, I have a son in high school. He's a junior, and I just can't do it right now. So the alternative for these people is to commute, which is expensive. Otherwise, you get a lot of Washington people.
Right, and I was about to ask that. I suppose it becomes more complicated when you're a president-elect who's run on the mantra of drain the swamp. So,
right,
you just can't turn around now and immediately fill your administration with Washington people.
You want to get some people from around the country, and certainly they want to serve. And you don't want to have it all be Washington.
How did Ronald Reagan strike that balance?
Well, we looked at people who wanted to serve. And because you've got all the people who want to be in the government, mm-hmm, and you've got all these government jobs, and you have to make them mesh somehow, mm-hmm, and you want people that these are presidential appointments, and they're supposed to carry out the president's policies. On the other hand, they have to work with the secretary of the department, and so they have to have a good working relationship. This is the guy with whom they're going to be holding the morning meeting every day.
Right.
And so you have to put all those things together.
All right, let's talk now about the Trump transition and the early days of the Trump White House. This is Thursday the 16th, so tomorrow is the four-week mark of his presidency, four weeks since Inauguration Day. The idea is to have a transition that achieves what? A White House that is staffed and a cabinet that's staffed so that you're ready, as the cliche goes, to govern from day one.
Right.
So walk us through what you've seen in this administration so far. Were they ready to govern from day one? And, well, give us a report card of sorts of how they've done.
Well, I think they weren't ready to govern from day one. They had several gaps in terms of who was confirmed. Mm-hmm. Some of these people were confirmed later in January or in February and are in office now. But they weren't, if you compare, I think you had some data on the confirmations in the Nixon administration, that many of the cabinet were confirmed in the first 20 minutes after the inauguration.
Right.
And so that was when the nominations were deemed sent to the Senate, because he couldn't do it until he was actually president. And they went in right away and they were confirmed. With Trump, unfortunately, there's been some question about whether some of these people would be confirmed. And some of them haven't been confirmed. Just today, we have a new Secretary of Labor, mm-hmm, the other Secretary of Labor having withdrawn. So we have a new Secretary of Labor. A Secretary of Labor who is considered likely to withdraw, who is under challenge,
right,
cannot really work on hiring or getting ready for sending to the Senate for confirmation undersecretaries and assistant secretaries, deputy secretary, whatever the positions are,
right,
in the administration. And so basically the Trump cabinet has been uncertain enough. Certainly some people were confirmed, like Jim Mattis, Kelly at Homeland Security,
right.
Department of State, and are on a roll. They're doing fine. But in other areas, he doesn't have the sub-cabinet that he would need to start carrying out policy, and the people have not had really the authority to negotiate and hire.
Right.
And so he's way behind.
Right. Now, he is not the first president in recent times to stumble into this problem. Barack Obama had three cabinet picks who withdrew between the time they were put forward and actually the confirmation. Two had skeletons in their closet, tax issues primarily.
Right.
The third one was Judd Gregg, the senator from New Hampshire, who he put up for commerce. And then Gregg decided, I can't really work with this administration. I don't agree with them on issues. So he withdrew. So they had three. They had three problems. Bill Clinton ran into a trap of sorts that he made. He was determined to have a woman as attorney general.
Right.
They were just locked on this. They just had to make this pick. And each time they found somebody, there'd be a problem. Nanny issues were the hang-up. Illegal immigrants were their nannies.
Oh, I remember.
Right. They ended up getting Janet Reno, but it's a painful process,
right,
if you will. So you've had other White Houses run into this problem. But I think one thing that might be different here is at the same time that Trump has had trouble with cabinet picks, there is the question of how well his White House is operating at the same time. Stephen Hess, who is a Brookings Institution scholar, has written a lot about transitions, and he has a rule of thumb, and I'm interested to see if you agree with this. He thinks that the smart transition process is you get your White House staff lined up first, your chief of staff, your counsel, your senior advisor. You get the key players lined up and ready to go by about Thanksgiving as a random target. Then you focus on the cabinet, and by Christmas you have your cabinet in place. Then by January 20th you can put the cabinet forward. Trump has not gone about that in its transition. Trump focused on cabinet picks early. He does pick his White House chief of staff and chief advisor a couple days after the election, but then you see other senior people like the press secretary, the counselor Kellyanne Conway. They're not coming in until right before Christmas. So you could make the argument that part of the problem is he did not focus on having a gelled White House early, and they're paying the price for that now.
I think you're absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they are paying the price for it. I think part of the reason for the White House staff not gelling and not being able then to create a transition team that works effectively on the next step, which is the departments,
right,
is that there's a lot of dissension within this White House staff. And this is an anti-establishment president. And I think Kellyanne Conway is at odds with some of the other people. And there was dissension about how to run this campaign and how Trump should present himself. And there was sort of these conflicts between speeches that he read carefully from teleprompters,
right,
and his more erratic, off-the-cuff remarks that sometimes got him into trouble. And so there has been that conflict all along, which is basically ultimately underneath probably a policy conflict, mm-hmm, about what he should be doing. And that's reflected in the difficulty in getting the people in place.
It is. Now, I would point out that it is possible to set up a White House where you have people from different backgrounds coming in. And again, I'd point to Ronald Reagan in 1981. I think Ed Meese made a comment to the extent that the White House would consist of nine guys from California. I think that was his famous line. But lo and behold, when the White House shop is open, there's a fellow named James Baker,
right,
who's sitting in a position of prominence. And he wasn't a California guy by any means.
That's true.
Right.
He wasn't. He had worked in the campaign. Mm-hmm. And he had supported the idea that Ronald Reagan should debate, and he negotiated the conditions for the debate. Those are they're always negotiated. You know, how long does this last? The questions, and where do the people sit or stand, and so forth. He
right.
negotiated that, and he was considered a better manager than Ed Meese. And Ed Meese really took over the policy role at the White House, both domestic and foreign to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Right, so they made it work. If you look at the way that the Trump transition has been set up, it On paper, it looks like a regular transition in this regard, and then I did a little homework on how they did it. They had a transition chair. It was Chris Christie and then later Mike Pence. They set up a group of six vice chairs, which eventually mushroomed to 13. There are some very prominent people in that mix who would go on to get big positions. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, Reince Priebus, who's now the White House Chief of Staff. Three of Trump's children were in the group of 13, plus Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who's now a White House aide. And they divided the work into two areas, one which they called agency action, which was six areas: national security, economic issues, domestic issues, defense, management slash budget, agency transformation, and innovation. And then a second area, which they called policy implementation, 12 areas, too many to read here, but just the nuts and bolts of government. It sounds on paper like they know what they're doing and this is orderly business, but yet we are looking at the results today and there is just a very large number of positions which have not been filled yet. So what do you think happened here?
Well, I think that the people that he selected for the cabinet, I think there's conflict about policy within the administration, and that his policies are not clear enough for people to proceed without conflict and without disagreement and without saying, okay, let's meet on that again or whatever. And therefore, and the policies are not clear enough, and his appointments have not been, some of them have been very good, and others have taken so long that there are still four or five cabinet positions. And just this week, we have the resignation of the National Security Advisor. And so the NSC is left without a head, which is supposed to be coordinating state and defense and other agencies that have something to do with foreign policy and national defense.
Right.
And so you look at something like trade, and you've got a United States Trade Representative, Bob Lighthizer, who's been nominated. He's got a long experience in doing this. He's technically competent. He's a good guy. And he has not been confirmed. Right. And there are no deputies appointed in that area. Mm-hmm. There's Deputy USTR.
Right.
And so in an area that we are now discussing, what are we going to tax the imports or the exports, or what are we going to do, right? And is NAFTA okay, or are we going to junk it altogether or revise it on the edges, or what's going to be the policy?
Right.
So the policy is very confused. The person who could get down to some specifics with the technical knowledge has not been confirmed. I think the Secretary of Commerce has not been confirmed.
No.
And there is an undersecretary or an assistant secretary in Commerce who deals with export matters who ought to be part of this discussion that's going on along with the USTR. So here are these people. We don't have them. You know, these are full-time jobs with the help of a competent staff that's been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. So there's nobody to do the job.
Now, if the USTR pick, he didn't roll that out until January the 3rd. So he's behind the curve on that one.
He's behind the curve.
But the rest of them, though, his last big pick before that is OMB director. That's December the 16th. And then the rest of the cabinet, is, with the exception of the Veterans Administration head, those were all December 16th or earlier. So
yeah, well, that's all right.
So he's on schedule on those.
That's all right. On picking the cabinet, he's on schedule, and most of them have been considered good picks. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Okay. So you mentioned...
I think, you know, his relationship with the Senate, certainly this party is trying to get along in terms of the Republicans, but he has insulted in the past a lot of the people he ran against and a lot of other Republicans. And so these relationships are not necessarily, the differences of opinion are there, but there's also some memory of having been insulted and wondering what's going to happen in the future. And so this isn't the smoothest relationship in terms of getting these people confirmed. Right. And also, I think the government continuously gets more difficult in terms of what is required on revealing what you've done in the past, what you own, you know, what you're going to do about it, and right. so forth.
Today's a good example of that divide with the Republican Senate. So he makes his replacement choice for Labor Secretary, and then the press breathlessly awaits a press release from Marco Rubio to praise the pick. Now, a Republican senator praising a pick should not be news in Washington.
Right.
But this relationship and the fact that he ran against Rubio and they said very bad things about each other, it thus becomes news when Marco Rubio is willing to throw a bone to Donald Trump.
Right.
You talked about policy and a concern about policy. Let me see if I get this right. Policy clarity within the Trump administration.
Right.
Is this a function of the campaign itself in which Trump ran, didn't necessarily run a let me see if I can characterize it properly. He ran on various policy concepts, but I would suggest it was a campaign that was much wider than it was deep in terms of policy.
Right.
Is it a function of a shallow policy campaign, or is it a function of a president who is kind of a walking contradiction of policies when it comes to Republican presidencies? Because I think this is part of the challenge a lot of Republicans have in terms of getting behind Donald Trump. You put aside the character, the personality, and it's a fact of the matter is you may like him on tax reform, but you don't like him on tariffs, for example. You may like him on one aspect of immigration, but not another. So there are a lot of little conflicting policy beliefs going into this president.
That I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And also, in comparison to previous Republicans, he has said that he would make no changes in Medicare and Social Security, that these are things people expected, they paid for, and they should get them. That's a huge part of the budget. And so he ends up with a budget problem where he's going to leave those programs alone. Mm-hmm. And he's going to increase defense and maybe veterans and infrastructure and cut taxes. And so nobody has said that this is a budget plan that's going to work out. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and he doesn't have a budget director yet.
Right.
Now, Ronald Reagan had a budget director early. He knew he was going to be a budget director, knew he was going to get confirmed, started working on the budget. I was working on it with him well before, going over to OMB now and then, well before the president was inaugurated.
This would be David Stockman. This would be David Stockman.
David Stockman, mm-hmm. Right. And David was bringing in, he had Alan Greenspan that he was consulting with, and he met with Ed Meese and me and Martin and said, do we really go for a big change in the budget by March? Or shall we postpone this for the next year? And we all supported his idea of going with a big change in the budget in March. Mm-hmm. Trump says he's going to come out with something in April, but he doesn't have a budget director yet.
There is a big reckoning coming in April in which he has to put out a budget.
Yeah.
He has to explain his blueprint. He also is going to be putting out tax reform. He's going to have to talk about how he's going to reconcile all these differences of budget, of wanting to spend on infrastructure, wanting to spend on defense, of wanting at the same time to cut taxes, which is going to have a revenue effect. And that OMB director is going to have to somehow magically produce
this. I tell you, that's the job from hell, OMB director.
Very funny. So you look at Ronald Reagan's first year in office, and he has a big accomplishment. He signs a tax reform measure. You look at
Tax and budget.
He has a curious path to getting there. We were talking about this. Reagan comes into office, and during his first 100 days, he is shot. And as a result of being shot, he then goes to Congress, gives a speech. He has momentum, actually, coming out of that. Not that anybody would want to experience this, but is newfound sympathy and respect for him having survived that, and that enables tax reform, and he gets that in August. He signs the bill at the Reagan Ranch in August of that year.
Right.
So he has a successful first year by that measure.
That's right.
Richard Nixon, if you go back to look at Richard Nixon in 1969 and 1970, it's a very productive presidency in his first couple of years. He also does tax reform with the Democratic Senate. He's doing a lot of interesting creative ideas, which you would not necessarily expect of a Republican. Creates EPA, for example.
That's
so
right.
It's a thoughtful presidency. How much of a factor is the transition in getting this kind of productive year going, this first year?
Well, I think it makes a difference. But Richard Nixon didn't have much of a transition at all. Most of the names of people to appoint to different positions were, as I said, you put the files in the bathtub and start over. And we tried to fill those jobs, and I think there's, you know, personnel office in the within the White House that continues to try to fill jobs that are presidential appointments. But he managed to do all right. He managed to recover from this. And perhaps there were many decisions that were made in the agencies that were not as consistent with what he ideally would have liked. But I think he got the defense and foreign policy areas going. And he had Henry Kissinger at State, I think, and later became also National Security Advisor. Maybe it was the other way around. And that was one of Nixon's main interests. And so he had a successful presidency, actually. And he initially, one of the things that he had been recommended to him by a policy staff, actually, by my husband, Martin Anderson, was abolishing the draft. And he set up a presidential commission and got people on all sides of the issues to debate that with the staff that got data together. And he succeeded in abolishing the military draft. It was a huge accomplishment.
Is it easier to conduct a presidential transition as the party out of power, or is it more difficult when you're succeeding party of the incumbent of the same party?
Well, I think it's much more difficult when you're out of power in terms of figuring out what's going on and what you need to do. Right. Otherwise, you've got a lot of people in place and they're in your party and you can change the ones that you want to do.
I ask because we've had only one transition that was a continuation of a presidency, if you will, which was 1988-89, Reagan to Bush. And there were tensions within that transition in terms of how many Reagan people would come over, how many Bush people would come over, who got what shots and so forth. And so I'm just curious from your aspect if that, if in some odd way that maybe that makes it more complicated.
Well, I think some of the Reagan people either stayed or whatever, but Bush wanted the reputation of the administration is that he got rid of the Reagan people.
I don't think
he did that completely, but he certainly got rid of some of them and put his own people in, and he didn't want people who had worked for Reagan. He wanted to be his own man, which is an understandable instinct. However, when a president has been in power for about 8 years, virtually everybody interested and capable has worked for the administration in one capacity or another.
Yes.
So if you reject those people, you're rejecting a huge body of knowledge and skill and connections and so forth. And getting some people who may be more junior and don't know what's going on.
So 27 of the 53 top people in the Bush 41 White House had Reagan administration ties.
Okay.
So there's a carryover effect.
So there is a very definite carryover.
But if I do remember, one thing which set kind of an awkward tone was that the Bush transition team had asked everybody in the Reagan White House who was thinking about staying on to hand in their resignation. Now, to me, this sounds like a pro forma thing to do. It's just sort of a polite thing to do, just as some organizations I know, when a governor or a senator is reelected, people turn in their resignation saying, if you want to replace me, go ahead, sir, knowing you probably won't. But I think some people in the Reagan White House took that perhaps the wrong way when they requested that. So there was just a funny tone there. Something else about the Bush 41 transition was that there was a bit of a sloppiness to it, and that was John Tower.
Yes. But, of course, John Tower had served in various positions. He had most recently taken investigated the Iran-Contra situation on behalf of President Reagan. And so he turned out to have a problem, I think, with alcohol.
It was a common, it was alcohol, I think there were women, there was coziness with defense contractors, it was a whole slew of things.
I don't think that's really should have been expected, right?
No, but it raises
given what he'd done
it
before.
Does raise the question of when you're working on a transition, how do you vet?
Well, that's an interesting question. You have formal requirements in terms of assets and
forms
income,
you have to hand in to declare.
Forms that you, financial right. reporting. Mm-hmm. And generally, as I recall, most of the people, there's a investigation by the FBI.
Right.
And the FBI looks into this and does a background check and talks to other people who know this person and says, have you ever seen this person drunk?
Exactly.
And so forth. And that should, that's got to happen sometime. Mm-hmm. And whether it happens before a nomination is announced or before it's sent to the Senate or before the confirmation, mm-hmm. Somewhere along there that has to happen, and I guess it did.
It does. So in this day and age, you can expect a fight over a nominee, and there's always going to be opposition. Rex Tillerson, for example, is confirmed by the Senate, and I think there were 43 votes against Tillerson to be Secretary of State.
43?
43, I think. If you look up Condoleezza Rice had 13, George Shultz had 0.
Right.
Hillary Clinton had 0. But this is the new age in which we live in which you put somebody up, and there's a question of whether or not there will be a fight. Back
right.
when you were doing Reagan transition and Nixon transition, was there ever the question of whether or not someone was confirmable? That Nixon statistic that you alluded to earlier, Richard Nixon on Inauguration Day 1969 sends his cabinet picks, 11 of the 12 who are in place, he sends them to the Senate. They are confirmed in 20 minutes.
Right.
And done in 20
minutes.
And
that's what you, that's, right. That seems to be what you ought to expect.
Right.
Right. I mean, they've had time
right.
before. After all, they've been in office since January 3rd, right? So but, they've been in office for a couple of weeks.
But doing this, say, during the Reagan years, was there ever a question of putting a name forward and thinking, my gosh, how does this person get
I don't think we ever had any doubt mm-hmm. about the Reagan appointees, about whether they would be confirmed.
Right.
And we assumed that they would be confirmed. And they all seemed to be solid people. If something had turned up, there might have been one, you know, mm-hmm. who ends up like Tower. But mm-hmm. basically, we expected them to be confirmed. And they expected to be confirmed. And they expected, therefore, that they could proceed with learning about their jobs, what the president's policies were, working with the White House staff, and interviewing the people who are going to be working for them in the sub-cabinet, so that when the inauguration comes, they're ready to go. We had 7 or 8 people in the Treasury who were already announced by the president to be appointed, and we actually had a dinner and got together with Alan Greenspan, Marty Anderson, David Stockman, and all these people who were going to be in the Treasury mm-hmm. and talked over the economic policy. And we had the monetary undersecretary and the undersecretary we had an assistant secretary for tax, we had a capital markets guy, we had a undersecretary for economic policy, assistant secretary for economic policy, and we had the legislative liaison, which every department needs, mm-hmm. and the PR people. So we were all ready to go.
Let me throw some good news, bad news at you. Donald Trump, on the day he's inaugurated as president, takes the oath of office, he submits 26 names to the United States Senate for confirmation. Barack Obama had submitted 35. George W. Bush, 43, had submitted only 13. So Donald Trump is somewhere between Barack Obama and right. W. Bush. On the other hand, the Washington Post keeps a track of these things. The Washington Post claims there are 694 at what they describe as, quote, key positions requiring Senate confirmation.
Okay.
That's cabinet secretaries, deputy assistant secretaries,
right.
chief financial officers, general counsel, heads of agencies, ambassadors,
right.
and what they call other critical leadership positions. Of that 694, they claim 23 are awaiting confirmation, 659 are awaiting nomination.
Okay.
And
that's for Trump?
That's for Trump.
And do they have a comparison with previous?
I did not see a comparison, but
you say 23?
23 awaiting confirmation, so 23 names have been put
sure.
forward. 659 are still waiting to be
So that's exactly the problem.
That is the problem.
That is the problem.
So in terms of looking at this White House right now, and it seems to be open season on criticizing this White House's performance, is this the biggest problem, that he just hasn't backfilled his executive branch, or do you look at other problems as outweighing that?
I think he hasn't backfilled the executive branch because some of his policies are uncertain and are not well thought out. And his immigration order, after all, is on hold by the courts,
right,
so that he needs to revise that. And the fact that that was poorly done reflects that that he isn't taking care, and he doesn't have enough people to say, we got to get this right, okay?
Right.
You do an executive order on an important topic like immigration, and whether people disagree or agree with your basic underlying philosophy, you've got to have good arguments that this is legal and it's got to be workable.
Right.
And it turns out that he had a problem with that. And that's a severe problem. That comes from having weak policy staff and not enough people who are really competent and who understand what the process of getting something right happens to be, that you need to bring in the lawyers and you've got the economists.
Right.
He has not even appointed a chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, let alone the other two people.
Right.
And now he's got his National Security Council guy resigning. And so this is weak policy, and it's reflected in everything else.
Right. It's also a communications problem in this regard. He doesn't have a communications director in the White House, and this is a spot that people usually clamor for because it's a great position to have to go into greater heights. The press secretary, Sean Spicer, is doing double duty as the communications
right.
director, and you saw in the immigration executive order, they were not ready to put this out. They did not have a physical copy to give to the press when he signed it. It took a couple of hours to get them a physical copy. It took them a couple of hours after that to get them a list of the seven countries that were affected by the executive order.
Right.
They had to wait till the next day. It took them till the next day to bring forward policy people to explain the policy. So
right.
they were behind the game when they, and this,
that's
and
right.
it killed them on the rollout. So
that's right.
bad hiring. So let's wrap this up with this question, this very softball question for, if you will. Your phone rings, and it's the Trump administration on line one. And they want you to come to Washington and sit down with them and say, help us fix this situation. What is your quick remedy for them?
Well, you know, I think one of the hopes that some people had with Trump was that they really did not want to see another Democratic administration, especially one run by Hillary Clinton. And they were hoping that Trump would change as the presidency became closer, that he would change after he got the nomination, or he would change after the election, or he would change after he was inaugurated, and he's not changing.
Right.
And so I think he actually is more committed to some of the things that sounded kind of radical while he was on the campaign trail. And so I think the problem is Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't have a solution for that. I think that you can recommend that he fill some of these jobs mm-hmm. with good people, some in the White House. You get a communications director, and I would agree with you on a communications
right.
director. And I remember, for instance, Herb Klein going in and basically creating the job of communications director under Nixon. And one of the things the communications director does, in addition to making sure all the stuff is available for the press, you've got the people and so forth, is communicating with the other press secretaries in the departments
right.
about what we're going to be working on today, or this is the position we're taking, we want you to support it. And, you know, we're trying to explain this today and make sure everybody, so let's all be on the same page. And there aren't any people out there in the departments. Who do you call? Okay? So it's still an understaffed government. So you got to bring in more competent people. That's the solution.
Well, maybe Donald Trump needs to buy a lot of copies of the Plum Book and start sending them out to people who voted for him in November. Maybe that's the answer.
Well, that's right. You can look up the Plum Book online. It's online. Even Plum Book will get it. You pick a job you want and send your resume to Washington, and maybe he'll pick you.
Could be. Annalise Anderson, it's been a pleasure to talk transition with you. I hope you'll come back soon, and we'll again take a measure of how the Trump presidency is going.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy choices confronting America's 45th president. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, I encourage you to sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which sends you the best work of Hoover Fellows, including Annalise Anderson, straight to your inbox. You can also follow Hoover on Facebook and Twitter, and our Twitter handle is @HooverInst, @HooverInst. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another edition of Area 45. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.